Welcome to ID the Future. I'm Rob Crowther here at the Center for Science and Culture. Since Darwin first proposed his theory of unguided evolution more than 150 years ago, doubts about the theory have been expressed by a parade of scientists and philosophers. Even now, there are prominent scientists with misgivings about the adequacy of neo-Darwinism. At the same time, staunch defenders of Darwinian evolution continue to claim that the case for a purely Darwinian account of human origins is beyond dispute. The public is constantly pummeled with media stories about new fossil fragments or scientific studies touted as further incontestable proof that the evidence for human evolution is overwhelming. But is it? Is the evidence for a Darwinian account of human origins really so persuasive? Science and Human Origins is a provocative new book from Discovery Institute Press, which boldly addresses some of these popular evolutionary arguments pertaining to controversial claims that humans and apes are related through common ancestry. Joining me today is one of the authors of Science and Human Origins, Casey Luskin, the research director for Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Welcome, Casey.
Oh, it's great to be here with you, Rob.
I really just want to get right into the nature of this book and what it is talking about and why it's so important. So maybe you can just give us a brief overview of the current state of the debate and how this book relates to that. And then after that, you know, I have some more detailed questions about the essays that you contributed to the book.
Sure. Well, obviously, in the larger debate over evolution and the origin of life, the question of human origins in particular has always been one of great significance. People want to know, where did humans specifically come from? And in particular, do we share a common ancestor with apes? And this issue has been talked about a lot in the scientific community over the last few years. There have been some very prominent fossils that have been discovered claiming that these are human common ancestors with apes, fossils like Ardipithecus ramidus and others. So this issue is being talked about a lot, and a lot of people want to know, what does the evidence say? And I would say that in both the fossil evidence and the genetic evidence, there are debates that are raging over whether the evidence really is incontrovertible that humans share a common ancestor with apes.
And so how does that play out in what the public hears? Yes, there's a debate in the scientific literature. How does that sort of trickle out to the media? I've seen a lot of articles about this, and I know people are reading them, but they don't always understand what they're talking about. So maybe you can cue us in on that so we understand a little bit better.
Well, last year there was a big story in NPR that talked about this question of whether humans share a common ancestor with apes and those sorts of questions. So this is an issue that, as far as the Darwin lobby is concerned, they're promoting it very heavily. In this story, there were some evolutionary scientists that were featured who said that the evidence that humans share a common ancestor with apes is incontrovertible. And they were speaking in that case specifically to the genetic evidence. We've also heard arguments that the fossil evidence that humans and apes share a common ancestor is beyond dispute. I remember in 2009, we were sitting at a hearing before the Texas State Board of Education, and we heard Ronald Wetherington, who's an anthropologist at Southern Methodist University, get up and say that when we look at the human fossil record, that there are no gaps and no lack of transitional fossils allegedly documenting our evolution from an ape-like ancestor some 5 or 6 million years ago. So the evolution lobby is pushing this view that humans shared a common ancestor with apes very heavily to the public. And again, people need to be able to sift the fact from the interpretation, the evidence from the rhetoric. What does the technical literature really say? One of the things that we have learned in both the genetic and the fossil evidence is that these sort of public rhetoric that the Darwin lobby puts out in favor of human common ancestry with apes is very, very strong. And they put forth this very united front that there is no reasonable way to dispute human common ancestry with apes. But when you look at the technical literature, you find a very different story.
So what you did in Science and Human Origins is look at that technical literature. And there are three authors, so you were one of them. And maybe you can tell us who the others are and just really quickly what each of you sort of focused on.
Sure. There were three authors in Science and Human Origins. The first author is Douglas Axe, who's the senior director at the Biologic Institute. He has a very strong background in molecular biology. He's published in journals like the Journal of Molecular Biology, PLOS One, and also in Biocomplexity, which is a new journal dedicated to testing and researching intelligent design. And Doug has done a lot of work looking at the ability of complex features to evolve, and he's asked questions about whether or not, in terms of human evolution, is there enough time in the fossil record for many complex features that we have to evolve by Darwinian evolution? Another scientist who co-authored the book is Ann Gager. She is also a biologist. She did her postdoc at Harvard University and has actually done quite a bit of work in population genetics. So what she has done is she's looked at some of these arguments from population genetics, which claim that humans and apes supposedly incontrovertibly shared a common ancestor. And she has found that these arguments really fall apart upon closer inspection, and that they're based upon many assumptions that really might not be valid. And I think that her chapter, chapter 5 in this book, is a wonderful expose and definitive refutation of many of these population genetics arguments that humans and apes shared a common ancestor. My background is in earth sciences. I got a bachelor's and master's in earth sciences from the University of California, San Diego, where I studied evolution extensively. And I've always had a strong interest in human origins. I published an article in the ID journal, Progress in Complexity, Information, and Design, a few years ago on human origins and intelligent design. So I was very glad to contribute a chapter to this new book, Science and Human Origins, updating those arguments, looking at a lot of the fossils that have been discovered in just the last few years, and asking the question, does the evidence really show that there are no gaps in the human fossil record, that there is this long line of transitional fossils showing an evolutionary sequence from an ape-like ancestor? And again, when you look at the technical literature, it's telling a very different story from what I would call are sort of the bluffs that evolutionary scientists are putting out to the public on human origins.
What I'd like you to do right now is just sort of explain to us what the overall story is that evolutionists tell regarding human origins, and I guess relate that to your examination of the fossil record.
Sure. Well, although the human and hominid fossil record is very fragmentary, there are sometimes millions of years where we have no fossils. And then when we do find the occasional fossil, those fossils themselves are very fragmented and just a few bones might be found. So although the human and hominid fossil record is very fragmentary, there is sort of a standard evolutionary story that we see presented in textbooks and the media. And the story goes something like this. And I'm not saying I agree with the story, but let's just understand what the story says. About 6 million years ago was the time when the common ancestor of humans and living apes like chimpanzees or gorillas lived. So this was about 6 million years ago. There are a couple of possible fossils which have been cited as perhaps being candidates for that common ancestor. One of them is a fossil named Aurorin tugensis, which is just a couple of bone scraps, a piece of a femur, a few other bone scraps. It's really not clear at all what it was. Another one of those fossils is a fossil called the Tomai skull, or Sahelanthropus tchadensis, which again is a fossil that consists of nothing more than a skull and bone fragments from the skull and some jaw pieces. So again, not a very complete fossil. Now the third fossil, which is sometimes said to be a possible candidate for a common ancestor of humans and apes, which lived about 6 or so million years ago, is called Ardipithecus ramidus, or Ardi for short. Ardi was discovered in the early 1990s, but in 2009, there were a bunch of papers that were published announcing Ardi to the public. And Ardi, again, is said to have been a more complete fossil than, say, the Tomai skull or Aurorin. And they even claim that they found the pelvis of Ardi, which shows that it was a bipedal common ancestor of humans and apes. We'll get into Ardi some more and why some of those reasons why it really might not have been a bipedal human ancestor and some of the challenges to that view.
Okay, so tell us about the next part of the story that is commonly put out there.
Well, after the early hominins that were about 5 to 6 million years ago, you have the Australopithecines, which lived from about 2 to 4 million years ago. Now, the Australopithecines, we do have a number of fossils, so we have a pretty good idea of what they looked like and what their morphology was. But there is still controversy over whether or not they served as an ancestral genus to our genus Homo. Our species is Homo sapiens. And so one of the most famous Australopithecine fossils is Lucy, which represented the species Australopithecus afarensis. And there are some severe questions about whether or not Lucy was ancestral to humans and whether or not Lucy really was sort of this very small bipedal ape-like creature that lived about 3 or so million years ago. Now, after the Australopithecines, you have to have some sort of an alleged evolutionary link between their genus and the genus Homo. And the classical example of the evolutionary link has been called Homo habilis. And for years, Homo habilis was classified within the genus Homo, which is our genus. Yet Homo habilis was a very small-brained member, supposedly, of our genus. But again, when you look at the technical literature, you find that a lot of scientists are challenging the status of Homo habilis as an evolutionary link between the Australopithecines and our genus Homo. In fact, a major review article in the journal Science from about 10 or 12 years ago found that Homo habilis is very much not at all like the genus Homo, and it should be classified with the Australopithecines. Finally, you get into the genus Homo. Our genus appears about 1.5 to 2 million years ago, and when it appears with a bang. In fact, some people even cited the Big Bang theory of our genus Homo. And so the problem with the genus Homo for evolutionists is that it appears abruptly in the fossil record without any clear evolutionary precursors. The Australopithecines really don't make a good candidate ancestor. And so you find that the genus Homo appears. There are certain members of the genus Homo, like Homo erectus, the Neanderthals, and then our species, Homo sapiens. We're all very similar, believe it or not, when you look at our skeletons and the bones that are known from these species. In fact, some scientists have suggested that perhaps Homo erectus, Neanderthals, and Homo sapiens and other members of the genus Homo, we all belong to the same species. We're that similar. And you can account for the differences in terms of small-scale microevolutionary changes. And so that essentially is the story of human evolution. You've got the early hominin fossils about 5 to 6 million years ago. Then you got the Australopithecines, which lived about 2 to 4 million years ago. And then they supposedly evolved into our genus Homo.
I've been called a Neanderthal, but I didn't usually buy it.
Well, and don't necessarily take it as an insult. Neanderthals actually had an average brain size that was larger than modern humans. So this whole idea that Neanderthals were these skulking, unintelligent brutes, that's not necessarily supported by the fossil evidence.
So when I read these stories in, you know, the Huffington Post or maybe in Smithsonian Magazine and things, they basically just link these up like you just did and say that everything runs together just, you know, in a really clear fashion. And yet, if you go to the scientific literature, it sounds like what you're saying is that a lot of the scientists are saying, no, these aren't the same groups. They didn't, you know, the line isn't that straight. You can't really connect them that way. Where does that disconnect come from? How's that happen?
Well, what you find in the fossil record is that the early hominin fossils from about 5 to 6 million years ago, they're very fragmented and they're very few and far between. It's not at all clear what they were, whether they walked upright, whether they led to the line that was leading to apes or the line that led to humans. Where do they fit in? It's really not clear at all when you look at the technical literature. These fossils are just too fragmentary. We don't have enough of them to know what they were or how they lived. The Australopithecines, when they appear abruptly. So you've got, again, this abrupt appearance phenomenon where the Australopithecines sort of pop out of nowhere without clear evolutionary precursors. And then the same thing happens with our genus Homo about 1 to 2 million years ago, that we pop into existence without clear evolutionary precursors. When you look at the technical literature, you find that this is readily admitted, that the genus Homo was radically different from its alleged Australopithecine ancestors in many different aspects of its behavior and its morphology and its intelligence in particular, and its mode of locomotion. So the genus Homo was a new type of organism. It is not documented, its evolution from sort of a transitional form from the Australopithecines to our genus. And so you find this pattern of abrupt appearance without clear evolutionary precursors. This is what you get when you look at the technical literature. Now, when you read MSNBC or the Associated Press or Smithsonian Magazine, you are told that we have this seamless transitional story from ancient early hominins to the Australopithecines to the genus Homo with transitional fossils at every step in between. And as Ronald Wetherington said before the Texas State Board of Education, there are no gaps and no lack of transitional fossils. This is sort of the united front, again, that's given to the public to sort of push this evolutionary view. But when you look at the technical literature, you find that nothing of the kind is the case, that the evidence actually suggests that we do not see clear evidence of human evolution from ape-like ancestors.
And that's exactly what your chapter in Science and Human Origins is dealing with?
Yes, it looks at the technical literature and scoured the literature looking for what does the evidence really say when you look at the original scientific papers and you find that there are severe and large gaps all over the place. Ernst Mayr, for example, said that the human genus is separated from the Australopithecines by a large unbridged gap, and that we don't have quote-unquote missing links to bridge this fossil gap. And there were a number of other leading anthropologists who said the exact same thing. So the field of paleoanthropology kind of has two sides. It has a side that it gives to the public and a side that it discusses in its technical literature. And those two stories are often very different.
I have one more question for you. What is a retroactive confession of ignorance? And how does that play into the debate over human origins?
Yeah, this is kind of an amusing thing, and you have to stay in the literature to get a sense for this. Basically, a retroactive confession of ignorance is the idea that only when evolutionary scientists think that they have found evidence to plug some gap will they finally admit that the gap was there. So, okay, they find a fossil which they claim documents the evolution of early hominins to the Australopithecines. And it's at this point that we found a paper in the journal Nature a few years ago which said, okay, the origins of Australopithecines up to this point have been obscured by a very sparse fossil record and we don't really know where they came from. But now that we have this new fossil, now we've explained the origin of the Australopithecines. And so again, they'll admit this gap was there only once they think they found the evidence to plug the gap. Now, the danger of doing these retroactive confessions of ignorance is that sometimes the evidence that you think plugged the gap really wasn't that strong. And in this case, I talked about this in my chapter, when they thought that they had plugged the gap, explaining the origin of the Australopithecines, it turned out that all they really found that plugged that gap were a couple of teeth that were said to be of intermediate masticatory robusticity, which basically means they were of a certain size that was sort of supposedly gave them intermediate size and chewing ability. I mean, this is the evidence that plugs the gap that makes the Australopithecines not come out of nowhere in the fossil record. Now, obviously, a couple of teeth is not going to explain the origin of an entire new genus. And we've seen many times in the past where this type of evidence turned out to be interpreted wrongly. So this is the danger where you admit that you have a gap, but then it turns out the evidence that you had really didn't plug that gap very well. And I think that we've seen this phenomenon over and over again in the years. The story, the lesson, the take-home lesson for people who are studying this issue is have a healthy dose of skepticism when you read media stories about human origins. They will often overstate the claims of the evolutionary evidence. They will often not report the many scientists that are skeptical of these evolutionary claims. So you need to always have a little bit of critical thinking and skepticism in the back of your mind whenever you're hearing some evolutionary scientists claim that we've solved the mystery of human origins.
Yes, they claim that constantly, too, in the media, because you get Ida or Artie or whatever new fossil there is every 18 months or so. And then the story is exactly like the last story. It's like the same exact story. They just changed the names. You know, oh, we finally found the fossil that it connects everything up. It turns out we were wrong about that last one, but this one really does it. And this happens over and over and over again. I guess that's what you mean by retroactive confession of ignorance.
Yeah, this is a theme that I tried to sort of put throughout my chapter in the book, in that we see that the media will promote these stories to the public that we found some fossil that's the best example of a human ancestor ever found, and then about 6 to 10 or 18 months later, that fossil falls apart. These stories follow the same arc. At first, they're heavily promoted to the public as evidence for evolution, but then over time, cooler and calmer heads will prevail, and scientists will begin to criticize this fossil, and they'll find out that it really was not the grand evidence of a human evolutionary ancestor that they once claimed that it was. So again, be skeptical when you hear these news stories claiming that the latest human evolutionary ancestor has been found. I can almost guarantee you that within a year or so, that ancestor is going to be picked apart by skeptical evolutionary scientists.
Well, whether you're skeptical or not, if you're interested in this, you need to read Science and Human Origins from Discovery Institute Press, and you can find it online at discoveryinstitutepress.org. Thanks, Casey, for being here with us on ID the Future.
Thanks for having me.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.